what, guys? Jokes. This is our first mother son.
That sounds a little strange when we say
I apologize
like
in advance to Eric Reynolds coming up. We'll talk about him. Episode 137. Welcome back to Game of Crimes. You're going to understand what we mean by that because episode 135 was Jonna Mendez, who I had the chance to go meet, share some stuff with her. Episode 136, Murph officially out of the doghouse. June Hawkins, the star, the lady, the detective behind the starting that whole investigation in Griselda Blanco. And then we get to do her son this episode.
You get to do him, huh? I tell you, it just gets worse and worse with the comments you're making here. Eric, I apologize to you, but I don't know what's wrong with Morgan this morning. I guess it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
It's 5 o'clock. Trust me, man. It's going to be 5 o'clock somewhere. Time to hit the winery this weekend. Hey, guys, well, before we get too far down the road, hey, welcome back. Thank you guys for joining us. Let's just get some quick housekeeping out of the way. Head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. Really, we appreciate it. Leave your comments. This is how people know, hey, is this something I want to listen to? You know, so it's magic. We don't know how it works. It's David Blaine, David Copperfield, you know, street magic all rolled into one. So head on over there. You can also leave comments on Spotify. So do that. Head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. You will see the pictures our next guest talks about that he didn't realize. And he's left some good comments on Facebook. I never saw those pictures before. That's why you got to come over to gameofcrimespodcast.com. Also, follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But where you got to be and what we just got through doing, we just got through recording one of our favorite Patreon episodes, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We just did You Can't Make This Shit Up. And trust me, you'll never look at a kilt again in the same way.
That's one of the grossest stories we've had on here so far.
And I'm going to give you a little taste of it on when we do our small town police blotter. But just suffice to say, you're never going to go into a grocery store again without checking things. Trust me.
Oh, please do.
Yeah. Please check. No, don't do that. Just check things. Make sure nothing has happened to it. Hey, but we got great stuff too. 911. What's your emergency? We've got our exclusive stuff for our Warden of the Throne people. You Can't Make This Shit Up. Case of the Month. 911. What's your emergency? Q&A. So. Guys, head on over there. We got a ton of stuff over at patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Now, you also got to go over to Game of Crimes fans. Type in that in the search function of Facebook. Pull that up, run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, the rules with the iron fist, with the velvet glove. Just put in a couple, answer a couple questions. And by the way, you know, one of the questions we had was, is this rift over between you and Sandy? There was never a rift between you and Sandy. You were just being held to a higher standard that says if you want to get out of the doghouse, you got to
never bring Miami Vice back on the show again.
And it is like Voldemort is the name that will never, from this point forward, we are never mentioning it again. So
just boom. Just the movie.
Yeah, we can talk about the series, but if you say it's Miami Vice, the series.
There you go.
If you say Redacted the movie, you're back in the doghouse again. All right. But head on over there, type in Game of Crimes fans, and just pull that up and just come join us.
Now, this, I was going to say, and I think this week's episode should really solidify the fact that I'm out of the doghouse with today's guest, but I don't want to get ahead of us.
I don't think so. No, I don't know. I didn't ask you.
I didn't ask you.
I get a vote in this. All right. Hey, guys. Well, as you can see, we talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We take the story seriously, but
if you haven't figured it out, we never take ourselves serious, and we're not going to because it's too much fun.
And we don't take ourselves seriously because there's that special magic time during our episode where we talk about certain things that are funny. And guess what time it is, Murph?
It's time for
Small Town Police Blotter.
Hey, this comes to us from Berlin, Pennsylvania, population 2003. And who knew this would happen in a town of 2003 people, but apparently, you know, Murph, have you ever left a transaction or something? You tell somebody, look, I got screwed, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Not this guy. He didn't get screwed. He's facing a Pennsylvania man is facing a criminal rap after he called 911 to report that a pair of prostitutes left his home without fully servicing him.
Oh, well.
He didn't get screwed. A guy named Jerry Spring paid $400, brought the two women back to his home. He hired them for the purpose of smoking smoke and engaging in sexual intercourse. Well, he explained that was supposed to be the agreement. He was supposed to be in the middle. He got sidelined. Nope, they didn't really care about him. They smoked his smoke, did not invite him into bed. And in fact, they apparently enjoyed each other's company and not his. So
that's appropriate.
In the end, that's figurative, not literal. In the end, he called the police and said, "Hey, I didn't get screwed." And they said, "Well, you're screwed now because y'all get charged with prostitution charges."
Oh, what an idiot.
Well, that's speaking of idiots, not that our next person is, a fellow fraternity brother. If you're out there and you're a Sigma Chi, let me know, because A.G. Harris IV, working for our Border Patrol, serving our community and our country down there in the Texas area, Tejas.
Good job, brother.
Sends this to me. So it's the shortened version of what we did on the longer version of You Can't Make the Shit Up. But remember when I told you, you'd never look at kilts the same way again?
Oh, I got to listen to this again.
You got to listen to this again. So Michael C. Vest is not a small guy. He is 6'6", 250 pounds, and he likes to wear kilts. And when he wears kilts, what does he like to do? He likes to go into antique stores and stick things up his rectum. Rectum? Damn near killed him. Thank you very much. The gallery manager said, "I had to watch it a couple of times to be sure I knew what I was looking at. He has placed several objects into his anus and returned them to the shelves." Oh. They knew it was the items because they were covered in bad things. So they charged him with one count of criminal mischief for his treatment of items, including a makeup brush, a restoration hardware piece, an antique bottle opener, and a tobacco tent can. So if you're in the market for any of those things, do not go in anywhere near Houston into an antique store and buy them.
Just, you know, just so glad that, you know, he's such a selective customer. Just sicko.
Sicko lot. Not everybody who waters a kilt is a sicko. I just want to remind you.
He makes up for all of them.
All right, Murphy, we're going to finish it out. 10 weird laws you may not know about Florida. You ready?
I'm ready.
In the state of Florida, it's illegal to park or drive over the top of a gravesite. Kind of seems, you know, okay, yeah. Here's one. If you have sex in any other position other than missionary, you're breaking the law.
No comment.
You can't prove a thing. In Florida, if you plant a flower in a pot without a drainage hole, you have created a public nuisance.
Oh, jeez.
If you are tried and convicted of horse theft, the penalty in Florida is still written as death by hangings. Don't go stealing horses.
I got no problem with that.
Here's one you might have a problem with. In the state of Florida, men may not be seen publicly in any kind of strapless gown.
Oh, I'm glad I gave up the strapless gowns long ago.
You can still wear gowns with straps, just not strapless, right? It's illegal to sell your children in Florida. Yeah, that's kind of, you know, we kind of knew that. In Palm Bay, Florida, and this would have to be the end of the world. It's illegal to tow a bobsled behind a bicycle. You got to have snow for a bobsled. Where are you going to get snow at in Palm Bay?
I'm just a few miles up from Palm Bay right now. I'm glad I didn't bring my snow sled over here.
That's right. In Florida, it's illegal to sell ice cream in a cemetery.
Why?
I don't know.
You need something to cheer you up.
No skateboarding in the state of Florida if you don't have a valid license. I'd like to see them enforce that. But here's the one. Murph, we're going to end up with this one. Having sexual relations with a porcupine is illegal in Florida.
You need to be told that?
Ow, 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 ow. Damn it. Stop. Hold still. Ow, ow.
Ow. He's shooting those things at me now. Stop it. Stop it.
Folks, as you can tell, it's been a long week. We've been doing a lot of recording, and it is Saturday morning. It is time to get out and get some sunshine.
Yes, it is. Oh, my goodness.
So how do we get sunshine? We get sunshine by bringing the first mother-son duo we've had on the episode, on the podcast, episode 137.
Yeah.
A gentleman by the name of Eric Reynolds, who, by the way, does not wear a kilt.
That we know of. And Eric, you don't feel obligated to tell us if you do or don't, brother. But this is kind of cool because when we were trying to track down June Hawkins' mom, Eric reached out on social media.
No, Eric's mom, not June Hawkins' mom.
I meant when we're trying to reach Eric's mother, June Hawkins.
There you go.
Eric reached out to me on social media, and turns out he was a former cop, retired police officer. I thought, well, man, this is really cool as this is starting to go. And then as we discussed his life and, you know, the fact that, you know, tell me something about your career. You're getting ready to hear a story, so I'm not going to tell you any of this now. You got to listen. This There are like five major sections to this interview with Eric. Any one of them is enough to take up a whole episode. The guy has had a very eventful life. He's had events happen in his life that have changed his life, but not for the bad, for the good. We'll let him tell you about the business he's involved with. And when we do the outro after his interview, we'll promote everything he's doing. But this is just, it's motivational. You might want to have your tissues handy on a couple parts of this because I needed a couple as he's going through some of the things that he's been involved with. But, I mean, you talk about somebody that's led an eventful life, who didn't let the odds get him down, who has gone on in retirement to help others, doing everything he can. And the things that happened in his personal life towards the end of his police career, wait till you hear that. There's just so many good things. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps here just talking about it, and I know the story.
Well, no, at your age, you forgot the story. Everything's new to you. You got to listen to the episode again.
There are days like that.
Hey, well, and one of them we wish we could forget is the kilt story. If you want to hear the whole kilt story, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and check out our latest You Can't Make This Shit Up. That's where you get the full kilt story. But if we're going to get to this full story, I have to ask you, Murph.
Yes.
Are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous and keto friendly, giving it away, the game of crimes?
Yeah, baby. So everybody get in, sit down, shut up, grab your tissues and hold on. Here comes Eric Reynolds.
Folks, this is history in the making because we're not going to tell. I think, Murph, this episode will come out after the other episode we were talking mm-hmm. about that this person is related to. So I can say it here. This will be the first mother-son combination.
Careful.
I'm being very careful for a podcast interview.
Hey, I'm the one from West Virginia now. If it was saying that to me, it would have a different meaning, you know?
So, which means that you're going to give us a lot of good stuff to use against your mother when we interview her. Now, by the time you hear this, you guys will all know we've got, well, first of all, let's just introduce him. Welcome to the show, Eric, the man, cops and campers, Reynolds.
Woo-hoo! Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you guys, man. Look at you guys.
Glad to have you on board, brother.
Well, you say that now again. Wait till you get to know us. That could all change.
That's very true.
Well, and Murph, I think you were kind of responsible for lining up. Now, I got to tell you, the way, as you'll hear when we talk with his mother, June, this all started because of Murph screwed up Patreon. He screwed up our narcometer. We do a narcometer review once a month. We'll review a movie, you know, or something. He picked Miami Vice, not the original series, the movie, the worst fucking movie I think ever made about cops. And he has been paying the price. So he gets off the hook. Sandy Salvato, our resident mafia queen who runs our fan page, said, Murph, we could get him off the hook if he can get an interview with your mother. And that's how this thing got started.
Absolutely. And I just, the time sequence is off here a little bit, but I just got June lined up last night for next week. So, but Eric actually reached out to me and I had reached out to Eric Newman, who's the producer and executive producer of Narcos and Griselda. And I'm not sure if that's how you found out about us, because I know Eric eventually reached out to June. I had to give him a little reminder. He's a busy man. But Eric reached out to me. I had no idea that June had a son that was a cop. And I called Morgan. I'm like, man, we got a first here. We got a mother-daughter thing going on.
Well, it tells me maybe she's embarrassed of him. I don't know. She never mentioned anything. Hey, you started it by calling me. We start this whole thing off for you guys even recording. He says, hey, how you doing, AAA? Okay. So there you go. We're even.
That's funny. That is true.
Right. No, I was just looking up you guys, and you know, all of a sudden I saw the podcast. I was like, oh, holy cow. I go, I bet. Them talking with my mom and my stepfather, Al Singleton, who was involved in those, even though he got cut to the, as he says, to the film floor, you know, because he's not really in it much. But I knew you guys would hit it off. I just thought, wow, what a combination of stories and experience that you guys are so relatable to each other, too. And, you know, what was going on at those times and dealing with the different government agents. I was like, man, this is going to be a fascinating interview. So that was one of the reasons that I reached out to you guys.
Yeah, the South Florida connection. I talked to your mom yesterday for about a half hour. It's going to be very interesting. We're going to have a lot of what's true, what's not true, because I heard a lot of what's not true yesterday.
Well,
wow, yeah.
Hey, but think about this. Here's why Game of Crimes. We're going to take a quick tangent, and talking about what we've been able to do. Take a look at Netflix and everything that Netflix has produced. Narcos Mexico. Now, Griselda. Mm-hmm. What's the common thread? We've got everybody now. We will have everybody from every one of those. We've had some tangential stuff with Narcos Mexico because I know some folks, we've tried to get like Jaime Kirkendall, some other folks, to talk, but we've got, because Javier, Javi was assigned there for a year or for a while, right? Working on that when he first came on. So,
well, plus we had Paul Crane and
Abe Perez,
yeah.
Yep. So we have got our fingers in everything that, where's our cut, Murph? Well, we
I've been asking that for 10 years now. Where's my cut?
Anyway, sorry, Eric. So you can see where we're going with this. It's kind of like this was the perfect storm. Now, with you now, obviously, and we're going to talk about, your relationship to the whole thing, because we understand you were key to solving many of the crimes that your mother.
Well, that was, after I got to talking to Eric and then I started researching on him, man, he's got a hell of a story here. And it's not just one incident. It's just not, I'm my mother's son. He has a very decorated career in law enforcement. What he went through, things that he started because of his career in law enforcement once he retired, and a great discovery in 2019, but we'll hold off on that because that is a hell of a story, man.
Saw that too. Saw the other article, the news interview about that too. So,
yeah,
it's pretty wild.
This is going to be. I'm telling the listeners here, listen up on this one because this man has a very varied past, a lot of things coming together and just working out to his benefit.
Well, for one of them being on our show with us, yes. I mean, you talk about this is the apex of his career, being on Game of Crime. It's all downhill from here, pal.
Yeah. I made it. I'm at the Super Bowl, right?
So. You're at the Super Bowl.
Eric, you got to raise those standards up, brother.
Hey, well, but as we do with everybody, thing of ours, Cosa Nostra. So we kind of got an idea kind of how you got started in this business, but let's talk. How did you get started in this business? How much of it was influenced by family? How much of it was you? Were you told to stay away from it, not get anywhere near it, and, ignore, parental advice? Like most kids do, how did you get started in this thing of ours?
Well, my mom, of course, she got hired in 1975. So I was only six. So I really never knew what was going on. I'm playing with Legos and solving Griselda crimes in the future, So I was like trying to figure out my niche, but no, she was always just my mom that had a cool job. I remember telling people, my mom's a police officer, and it was jaw dropping, like 1980 when, I'm 10, nobody was saying that, and I had to explain a lot of reason why my dad wasn't around too sometimes, because I was one of the only kids around then that had a divorce. I came from a divorced family, and my dad was not around because he was doing the Air Force stuff. He was bouncing around, and so I really built an attachment to my mother. And then obviously my grandmother, being a Cuban, citizen from Cuba, helped raise me. And as I was growing up, I always got involved in like neighborhood stuff. I was like the little community cop breaking up fights. I was a bully slayer, and I learned how to fight because one of my stepfathers was, he's a little, he was a customs agent back then, but he taught me how to box a little bit. And so I took out my aggressions on bullies, and dad's not around, take this, But I'd get paddled and, I was bouncing around a lot of different schools while my mom's trying to manage that career and manage. Maybe he should be with his father. Maybe he should be with me. There's a lot of that going on. And she got me into sports. Football, especially down there in Miami, became my passion. And that's what occupied my time. I became part of a team. My coaches, like in high school, she was in the gang unit. Well, guess what? They worked in the gang unit. So I had eyes always on me. All the time, even though she wasn't there, she made me feel like, I had police cars take me to practice if she was running late, a squad car come pick me up, drop me off at Kendall Broncos.
Don't you hate it when some dude looks like Joe Shithead the Rag Man, look like he fell out of a trash can, walks up and says, "Your mom says, keep your nose clean," and then walks in.
hey, too, tell, we haven't even told them who your mom really is. We just alluded to her first name. Tell everybody who your mom is.
Oh, so she's Detective June Hawkins from the Griselda, show. And she's the star, I guess, on the opposite side of Griselda, you know, Griselda Blanco's character. So here you got these two alpha females fighting in a man's world and trying to succeed. So they really took it and ran with it, especially nowadays. You know, they probably lose in control with two women in this position. And that's, you know, that's what I came up with. You know, all the men in my life were usually law enforcement or military something. You know, there was always this, one of my mom's boyfriends was like Clint Eastwood. You know, he was very silent, didn't do much, but when he did, it was epic. Like, we walked out of 7-Eleven one time, and there's a guy leaning on his car, and he just knocked the guy right off the car, right onto the ground. And then we got in the car, and we drove away, and I'm sitting there, like, not knowing how to feel as, like, a 12-year-old kid, but I was like, that was the coolest shit I ever saw, right?
It's kind of like, was it six shots or was it five? Well, seeing this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world. You got to ask yourself that one question.
He was a bomb squad guy. He did tour in Vietnam, so he definitely was not
one. He knew the stuff, yeah.
He taught me how to make M80s and stuff in this garage. He was making bullets. So I learned all kinds of weird, cool things, you know.
Oh, it seems to me like you were like maybe just one paycheck away from going to the dark side. You could have been a cop or a, you know, terrorist, man.
Well, I could have definitely. I had the eye of the Vato. You know, there was times as a kid I was very tempted to do some stupid knucklehead stuff, you know, but my mom's presence and always in the back of my mind about not disappointing the family name and have honor in yourself and kind of stuff she used in her career, I guess it did pass down to me. Now, there was some times when, you know, I'm trying to outsmart her. And she has to attitude check me, like holding a broom and about to hit me with it, saying, you ain't that big. I'll, you know, if you don't watch your attitude, I'll freaking call some boys over here to rough you up. And, you know, I feared that little woman walking around the house. Here I am, a football player, 6 foot, 200 pounds. And there's this little, you know, just like you see in the movies, little barking dog controlling the big dog. That was her. And she was the memo queen. Everywhere I would go, there'd be a note. I go to the toilet. There's a big, I have to go to the bathroom when I wake up, right? And it says, laundry, vacuum, empty the trash. It'd just be a list of crap to do, you know? And it was always busy work. That's all she was trying to do, make me contribute to the house and also, you know, be busy, you know? Because for that reason, she didn't want me breaking into houses or doing some, you know, especially on a day off at school or summertime break. But
I figured that note in the bathroom said, put the seat down.
No, she let me pee standing up. She was, I think she understands the man's world sometimes. You just got to let that one go. But now my wife now, she's like, can you sit? I'm like, no. I'll go outside.
That's so European. No, I'm standing, please.
She's Turkish, and she's like, she grew up with three brothers and cleaning the bathrooms with the urine. She just kind of, that annoyed her. And then she got her brothers to sit, and I'm like, nah, not this guy.
You know? I just saw a meme on the internet. It talked about the Japanese have got the best toilets in the world, yet they have no Taco Bells over there to take advantage of the toilets. I mean,
What a waste.
I do like the bidet, though. That is a nice little treat now and then, you know. But
first bidet I ran into was over in the United Arab Emirates, and I'm looking at this thing going, what in the hell is this? Because I'd never seen one before.
Morgan's thinking, what'd they put a water fountain in the bathroom for?
I was thinking that too.
One big water fountain, too. Why is it so low to the ground? And what's this pedal here?
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I was saying, what were you going to ask me? Sorry.
I was just wondering if you grew up speaking Spanish.
Now, that's one of the interesting things. I'm not fluent. I do, when I'm around it, I pick it back up because my grandmother and mom would talk Spanish. But, you know, I'm going to American schools. You know, I'm around my friends. There weren't Spanish at the time. You know, I was one of the few Spanish kids. You know, we were around, but, you know, you're talking late 70s and then early 80s when I got into sports. So my grandmother would try, you know, they had me doing lessons and all that. And I took Spanish classes, which was always just a, you know, that's the hour to goof off and all that. So my mom was lucky enough to go to Cuba for the summers and experience having to talk the language in the town and in the community. And, you know, obviously in their household with my aunt, it was pretty much how they talked. I never got to go to Cuba. I mean, Castro took over and all that stuff's happened, you know, and so there's no way for me to, you know, you got to be in the culture really interacting and really, you know, you could go to Little Havana now, live down there and probably get the same experience, but we didn't have that going on. So I'm not fluent in it. I couldn't testify and say, yeah, I heard him say that in Spanish 100%, you know, and I regret that. I wish I would have had more, you know, would have helped me in my career. I was thinking about that the other day, thinking about how much doors opened up for her being able to understand the language and to do wiretaps. And I'm like, man, I could have been like I started to learn Creole, some just certain words to be able to get the gangbangers to come over to me, like Vinny La, you know, and stuff like they, oh, this guy knows Creole, this white cop walking up to me, even though I'm Hispanic, they don't know that I'm just.
Well, because your name is Elmer Thibodeau. So,
yeah. And then that's all I would know, a couple of words, but it was enough to get the job done.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wish I would have learned the language, you know, and then obviously, like I was saying, playing football and all those sports made me part of a team. And it was, you know, your offensive guy would score a touchdown, but you were part of it. It was that kind of, I didn't have to be the star, but I was part of the operation.
So when this was going on with your mom and Griselda, how old were you when that was going on?
I would have been 9 and 10. So I was a little younger than the kid they have in the show. They had said they're going to have a 12 to 14 year old. And he actually, Doug asked me, what were you doing at 14? And I was like, well,
you don't want to know.
Let's just say I discovered myself in girls. And he was like, well, we're not going to put that in. I'm like, well, video games, baseball, you know? And I think they went with the baseball theme. So it's pretty funny.
Hey, can you tell when you said Doug, who's Doug?
Oh, Doug Myra, one of the executive producers of the whole Narcos. He had actually, he's the one that called me originally, getting back to my mom. And when I thought they were asking me to be on some show. And I was like, no, we're going to talk to your mom. I was like, oh, okay. My mom again. Yeah, what? Another award, another book. You know, I'm just joking. You know, I always say I'm the third best cop in the family, you know, and that's all right because those are some big shoes to fill. You know, I'm glad I got out of it unscathed, you know. But yeah, the sense of belonging, being part of something, almost like that military mindset, like a platoon. That's how our, you know, we were pretty much all our coaches were military guys anyway. So they came from that structure. So when I got in after college, you know, I went to Florida State. Was going to be FBI agent. That's what I originally thought I was going to be. And then I took the test.
Oh, sorry. Interview's over.
No. Hey, I didn't make it. They didn't want me. I guess I was too wild, you know. But, and then I just started messing around catching shoplifters after college for a department store, you know, and that was fun. And because we got to dress plain clothes, play undercover, act like I'm shopping, looking at socks. And meanwhile, guys loading up on jeans. I mean, it's probably why I got so much heart disease now. My adrenaline dumps were like crazy at that point, tackling guys in the park. And this is the 90s. We could chase them through stores.
When you could do that. Now you can just watch them walk out. I'm watching videos of people just walking out the door with the frickin' not in Vermont, though. Just saw a video this morning. Vermont, they beat the shit out of a guy who walked out with a shopping cart full of stuff and then tried to keep one of the Makita drills. There's like 6-7 angry old Vermonter men around him just beating the snot out of him.
That's how I grew up, right and wrong. You know, that's how it was. And when somebody was doing something that just wasn't right, I always got involved. And I think that's where it came from. My mom was always, you got to stand up for who you are. You know, she always treated everyone the same, from the housekeepers that worked at the department that were cleaning up. She'd get them Christmas gifts. She'd know everybody, you know, and she would just treat everyone equal.
That's informant development, man. That's it. Real quick, before we pass off too much into college, when you were 9 or 10, did you have any clue about the seriousness of what she was working on at the time? Well, this episode is not about her, but it's about you inside that episode. But did you know anything? Did you have any clue about how serious it was at that age?
No, I had no idea that she could have potentially had a contract put out on her, on, you know. So, I mean, it's looking back, I was like, holy cow, you know. And you come home and, you know, I get a bedtime story, you know, and here she is. Probably, I can imagine. I talk to my kids now and it's like all the things that are going through my head and trying to still be a good dad, you know. It's like, it's a tough, you know, but she was able to do it. And I saw her cool gun belts. I saw, you know, I saw the toys. It was awesome, you know, pepper spray, which I found out when I was 7, I sprayed it and it was mace then. It wasn't the nice pepper spray they have now.
It wasn't the oleoresin capsicum, the cayenne pepper that fires your ass up. It was like the stuff that would, like, okay, that's kind of irritating, but, you know.
Yeah, this stuff I remember being pretty bad, but I put a riot helmet on and, you know, she originally got assigned to Jackson Memorial Hospital right after the academy. And that was like her first precinct because they had a bunch of rapes going on of the nurses at the hospital. So they started just having cops there and eventually the rape stopped. So they never caught anybody. I don't know if it was staff, it was somebody just coming through, delivery guy, who knows. But that's where she started getting introduced to different aspects of that world, because I remember her introducing me to a guy that had no legs. He had his legs blown off in a car. And I was very impressionable. I must have been 8 years old. And it, you know, to see somebody like that, and we were seeing veterans and we were seeing stuff coming out of, you know, that time period. And I remember it being, I felt so sad for that guy having no legs, you know. And I asked her the other day when all this stirred up with Griselda, I'm like, Mom, who was that guy with no legs you introduced me? She's like, oh, that was so-and-so. He was a radio disc jockey, and he was against Cuba, so he was anti-Castro. And I guess that other side had set up a bomb in his car, and the Cubans were big on blowing stuff up with bombs and stuff. So his car blew his legs off. And she was guarding him and would take him to physical therapy back and forth. So I think I might have gone with him one time to physical therapy. I may have been in the back seat, just, you know, she had to scoop me up and finish doing what she was doing. So, you know, he was a Cuban guy, so she started, you know, hey, what's going on? And I think that just opened up her path and being able to use the language and her being Cuban to be able to get onto that side of it, you know, and well, understand.
I remember Jackson was the trauma center down there in downtown Miami. That's where my partner got shot there in Hialeah in 1989, and that's where we took him.
Yep, that's where she was, you know. And
So Murph, you had to overlap then with her.
Yeah, I was there 87 to 91. I'm not sure which year she retired.
She retired in 03. She was out of that area by, you know, obviously when the investigation with Griselda, by the early, by 80s, she was out of that area.
Yeah. Was she Miami PD or Metro Dade?
She was Metro Dade.
Okay. Yeah. Because one of the articles I was reading about her yesterday said she was Miami police.
Yeah, I've been.
You know how the paper is. They confuse stuff. It's Las Vegas Metro, you know, and other stuff. They just don't.
Yeah.
They don't get it. But that's like confusing, you know, Florida and Florida State. I mean, there's no issue there, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. One of them. Yeah.
Say hello to my little friend.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about that stuff, like her seeing dead bodies. And obviously after my career now, knowing through the traumas that I saw, which wasn't on her level. I mean, yeah, she always says, yeah, I saw drug dealers getting killed and people in the, but you saw people that maybe weren't as bad as others. And I know it affects you. And I just can't imagine I was in traffic for a little bit. I got to see a lot of dead bodies that way. And you do build up, you know, you get desensitized to it. So
you build up, but you have to compartmentalize. Otherwise, you just fall apart at each call. But let's talk about your getting into police work. So you went to college, you tried for the FBI. But what did you do after that? What were you doing? You said you were doing some like loss prevention, shoplifting. But was Boynton Beach your first cop job or did you work somewhere else?
So going to Florida State, I partied a little bit. And back in the 90s, they had a real issue.
I'm shocked.
They had a real issue if you had smoked any marijuana after age 21. That was a big thing in a lot of these applications I was filling out. And unfortunately, it took me 6 years to get out of Florida State. I worked through school. My mom actually got promoted to sergeant while I was in college, and she took a pay deduction to be a sergeant on the road compared to what she was making, you know, in overtime and homicide and stuff like that. So all of a sudden I took out a student loan. I'm working in restaurants. You know, that first year of easy sailing, mom paid for the dorm and all that. It was out the window, but it was good. You know, I had to work, manage a schedule and all that. So when I, got out of, I'm sorry, you were asking me about college and I got sidetracked. Oh, yeah, about drugs. So the marijuana thing kept jamming me up. You know, I applied at her department. You know, I failed the polygraph because they asked me if I smoked weed after age 21. And you know, I'm like, no. And the thing goes, you know, so it wasn't going to do it. And then I learned that later on about the whole using your butt muscle and your sphincter to control shit. So, I mean, that was later on. I figured that out and I didn't need it then. You know, I had the secret. I didn't need the secret then. So anyways, I kept getting the door slammed on me. And I was like, man, I guess I'll just go up the corporate ladder of the retail world because I was doing very well. I was managing my own store in Boynton Beach. I started in Boca, got promoted to the Boynton Beach store.
What kind of store? Like clothing or?
Yeah, like a Macy's.
Okay.
So it was, you know, I had my own 4-person team, and that store at the time was getting killed. And it didn't have a camera system. So they were bringing in a camera system. And then, boom, we started catching one a day, two a day. Big cases with employees just getting, you know, truckloads of stuff out the back. And that got me into the investigative side of things. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool, you know. And meanwhile, the Boynton cops are always coming in. They're like, hey, you got another shoplifter again? Where'd you chase this guy to? I'm like, oh, man, he ran through the cow pastures. Look at me. I'm covered in cow dunk, you know. And it would just, you know, you get to know the same cops working the same. And they're like, hey, man, you ever think about how come on board with us? And I was like, I try to keep disqualifying me all the time for the weed. And they were like, well, apply our department. So I applied with them and they disqualified me also. And I ended up dispatching. I went down to Sunny Isles Beach in Miami because my mom had a friend. And she goes, hey, why don't you start dispatching? Because they don't care about the weed, because I'm not out there on, you know, they do, but it wasn't as big of an issue. So I got my foot in the door dispatching for about 6 months, called Boynton Beach again, because my girlfriend lived up there at the time. Hey, you guys hiring dispatchers? You know, I was going to make the lateral switch over. And like, nope, we do have a PSA, a community service officer position. And I'm like, what's that? You wear a uniform, no gun, and you do traffic crashes and non-in-progress type calls, you know, delayed burglary or some shit like that. And I was like, all right, less money. So I kept my retail security job on the side. Never told anybody. I was doing morning shifts, whatever I could to supplement my income, because the $10 an hour as a community service officer wasn't cutting it. But I knew that was my way in. Did that 6 months, sent a memo up the chain. My mom helped me write that memo too. So went straight up to the chief. He signed off on it. Great memo. Next thing you know, I'm in academy 3 months later. So, you know, I just had to prove myself a little bit, you know, not be a nuisance. And it turned into a great training program to bring in guys, let them do the road patrol, like as a, just doing crashes, knowing the geography, learning the radio, learning the department without that much of an investment from the department. And then you can weed them out, or, hey, he's ready to go to the next level.
Kind of like an apprentice program. You bring them in, you try them out, not a lot of risk, you know, not a lot of training involved, but you can see, are they going to be fit for it? And then if they're a good apprentice, then you can, you know, work them into the academy. So how old were you when you finally got a real cop job?
31.
Okay.
You were persistent,
my friend.
Well, 24, graduated college. And then, you know, I didn't really think about being a cop for a couple of years. And then I started that process, the shotgun approach, applying to every department I could. And I started, you know, hey, sorry, son, but are you certified? And I wasn't, you know, so I was going to be self whatever at that point, self sponsored. So, yeah, I kept working. And then, you know, by 32, I remember finally being sworn after the academy. And I wasn't the oldest guy in my class. There was only about 20 of us. And, you know, that was, I guess, just the beginning. You know, I look back at those pictures. I was such a young, fresh, you know, guy, even at 32, compared to where I look now, you know, like all of us.
What do you mean? What are you trying to say here?
I'm just saying that, is that white or gray or is that blonde? Maybe that's the light that's reflecting that.
A lot.
Look at this.
I got so much hair, I have to put a hat around it right now to keep it in place from, you know, going over my front of my face like the Beatles, you know.
This looks like the Silver Fox Show.
It is, man. And by the way, it's all Tommy Bahama. Yes, thanks for noticing. What's that, Murph? Is that a timeout or is that an X?
No, that's an X, like Tommy Bahama.
Well, I couldn't tell if it was that or, you know, by the way, you know what you have in common with Murph? You said it took you 6 years to get through Florida State. Same amount of time to get through third grade.
Hey, all right. Well, you should
he was the oldest guy in his class, you know.
You should hear how many years it took me to get through college.
You should hear how many years it took him to get on DEA.
You were a lady killer your senior year in high school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I was the oldest guy there.
You were like 21.
He could buy booze. Yes. Well, you could still buy booze. I could buy booze at 18 when I was in college. Liquor was 21, but you could buy beer, you know, at 18. So
that makes sense.
Life is, yeah, trust me, it was Kansas. But so, hey, so you start off. So tell us a little bit about the area. Tell us a bit about Boynton Beach. Now, how big's the department? You know, where is it located at? You know, what kind of community is it?
It's a city, right? I would say it's in between Delray Beach and West Palm Beach. So it's in that, you know.
Oh, that highfalutin area, man.
Well, you got Boca Raton over here. You got Jupiter, you know, and Palm Beach Gardens. There's this whole stream of cities, and we're one of the cities in that path. And obviously,
that's on what they call the intercoastal, right next to it?
Yeah, they say beach, but there ain't no beach in Boynton. They sold it to Ocean Ridge, so it's just, it's some propaganda or something. Maybe some drug dealer unloaded it back in the day, because our old inlet over there was pretty common for having a lot of boats coming through, what I've heard from the old guys. But yeah, about 160 police officers. It's 16 square miles, but we have everything in that city. We have our hood. We have our rich golf courses. We have our shopping centers. We do have the intercoastal with the boat ramps and some, you know, banana boat and stuff like that, you know. And it's a busy, you can get into everything there that you can in a big county, except it's just smaller numbers. You know, that spot in D Bureau may not open up for a while, you know, because the guy's going to be there, you know. And that's the kind of, you know, I understood that getting into it. My mom coming from 4,000 or 5,000 officers and the opportunities there, versus this department. So just getting in the door was the first step. And then as you're getting in, you start plotting, you know, like, all right, where do I want to be? Well, I had a heavy influence in traffic. I went to traffic homicide school, the first level, and I was like, all right, this is my path. Well, I never ended up back in traffic ever again. It's funny how that stuff works, you know, and ended up doing some community outreach, some vice work. We did this program called the JAM unit where we monitored low risk juvenile offenders that maybe had done a burglary or two, nothing like robberies, some of them, but for the most part. And we would check on their curfews, their grades in school. We would just be a big brother in their lives, a pain in the butt, because we could arrest them for violating their little probations. And we would just keep an eye on them. And that became, you know, got us in the communities, talking to the parents or lack of parents, and, you know, understanding these kids. And sometimes we would get some tips on others. You know, they know what's going on in the neighborhood, right? So it was such a beneficial thing. And of course, you change chiefs, you know, and then, oh, we want to use resources here, the typical, you know, shell game of moving money around and guys around. And then when I was in a bike unit, you know, a lot of guys would look at the guys riding around on bicycles doing mall security type work, even though we were making a difference. I mean, we caught armed felons, shoplifters in progress. Our deterrent there, we would show, hey, there's no crimes going on when we're roaming around. But guys get jealous and we're not handling the calls they think. You know, and then a boss gets into power and he's like, I don't want this bike unit. You know, get these guys out of here, put them in cars. And that's kind of how it was going. So I was like, all right, I guess I'm going to have to look at supervisor route. So I started, I went to FTO school and I was preparing to start doing the whole FTO process and training guys. They always gave me ride alongs anyways. You know, I was always pretty, being a more of a mature guy at that point and having the excitement of being in, you know, foot pursuits with guys and hand-to-hand combat with these hitting with handcuffs and breaking stuff in parking lots. I was already ready to control my emotions. And so I was really good. And I was like, I think I could do the FTO thing, you know, and then 2012, I'm on road patrol, a typical day, you know, a Tuesday afternoon and the bolo comes out. Hey, there was a bank robbery in Del Rey. And I'm like,
yeah, wow. So before we get into that, let's dive into a couple things. So as you started getting older in this, and now we're going to talk. So when you first got on Boynton Beach, what year was that?
I got on in 2001.
Okay. So what we're going to talk about, the event we're going to talk about here is about 11 years later.
Right.
So, but when you got on, so, cause I want to kind of tie this back to your mom a little bit. When did you first realize about how significant her investigation about Griselda was going to be? Because I mean, you're in the know now. I mean, you got an appreciation for stuff. Did she talk about it much? Or, you know, when did you finally realize that this was a big deal?
I didn't even really pay attention to those days. I didn't know about them. Because after that, she got involved in a big investigation called the Pillowcase Rapist that was going on in the 90s. You know, obviously, you can know what he was doing. And she was, I remember that as a kid. Because I think I was like 12 and 13. This is 83. I'm guessing at the time. I remember her being involved in that a lot. And we had, I don't remember if they caught the guy or if he turned up later on from some DNA scan or whatever. But I never even knew about Griselda until the cops and, Cocaine Cowboys came out. Because the authors had already been talking to Al, my stepfather, about those days, and they talked to my mom too, and then they eventually talked to them both. That's how I think my mom and Al started kicking it. They, you know, were hanging out talking about the old days together, and they were both single at the time. I was like, hey, what are you doing tomorrow, you know? And next thing you know, he moved in though when I was off at college. I noticed I wasn't around to watch everything, you know. I was trying to find my own way, and he just slid right in, man. Not literally. Sorry, I hate to say, but he was called the Blade. That was his nickname. So
the Blade.
Yeah. So all of a sudden he comes up to visit. I'm like, oh, your mom's new boyfriend, huh? This guy. You know, I didn't know who he was and what an awesome man he is. But at the time, you know, you're still a little judged. You know, I'm judging all these cats. You know,
well, you're also protective.
Dirty Harry before you. Come on.
Yeah. Well, you're protective of your mother too, like most sons are. You know, you want to know, you know, she being treated right, you know, everything, you know. But that's interesting too, because it's the same thing. We had this discussion with you as well, Murph. It's like they did, you know, they dealt with Pablo. He's over. Dave Mitchell, Chris Feist will come down, do the Cali cartel. That's done. That's over. Nobody really cares about it. You know, it's like job is done. Mission's over. Nobody cares about it until you know, years later to where all of a sudden it's interesting. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, Murph tells the story better than I do, but they turned down several offers because it's like, nah, you guys don't want to do this until, you know, Eric Newman comes along and makes the pitch, which I think was the reason I tie that together, because I think it's interesting because I think it's kind of the same thing, right? And we'll talk about this later too, but you don't want to turn these folks into folk heroes, you know, the Griseldas, the Pablos and stuff. You don't want to make them look like, oh, they're Robin Hood and stuff. I mean, these were, you know, and you were dealing with a lot of bad people down there too, because I got to imagine during your time there, even the 2000s, drugs, gang activity, you know, all that stuff was still, had to be the staple kind of your work going on in Boynton Beach, right?
Yeah, looking back, we, you know, we had the gang wars going on. We had a Christmas Eve, or was it a Black Friday? Either Christmas Eve or Black Friday shooting at our mall. So, and this is 2006, so the mall thing wasn't as big. It had happened, but wasn't like, you know, now in the school shooting, it seems like the thing to do. So I remember that being a big event. And then, you know, going out on active patrols, pulling over boys, just trying to, you know, toss cars, get guns off the street, because we had them, you know, they were starting to kill each other and it was starting to become an issue. I think they were called Top Six. That was the gang. And then we had the opioid crisis going on, you know, and some of the investigations we were involved in were seizing all these doctors' assets that were doing this pill thing, you know, because we had cops involved in the DEA doing task force work and stuff like that. And it was just such an eye-opening experience. And all the dead bodies that we had to look at, you know, we have a large retirement community here. So obviously they find grandpa dead, we get the call, you're first one on scene usually, or, you know, next to the person that found them. And we were taught, put the gloves on, you got to roll that guy over, make sure there ain't no stab wounds and all this. You're supposed to inspect the body. Now we back off a little bit because of crime scene stuff. But at the time, they still wanted us young guys to really get your hands dirty, you know? So the amount of old people we were flipping over and just like, you know, you meet the family, you're hanging around. I mean, how many times you're sitting in there with a dead body in the room, you're waiting on the body snatchers and you're just kind of absorbing all of it, you know, like, wow, there's his grandkids in that picture. And, you know, and then I have to start itemizing all the narcotics or drugs that are in the cabinets because we had problems with people breaking in to a dead guy's house stealing the drugs.
They'd read it in the paper. Yeah, they'd see it in the paper. So-and-so passed away. And then, you know, somebody goes and hits their house.
Yeah. So I'm writing. I remember writing on the death stuff, the certain thing you got to send to the ME's office that they send to the doctor, you know, an authorization to sign off. And my hand used to cramp up writing the drugs that we had to write on the form. And I remember I couldn't spell a lot of them because it was like X's and Y's. And, you know, I think they do that on purpose. And I said, this is what killed this guy. You know, all these bags of drugs. I mean, he's got this to help him pee, this for an erection, this for because he can't sleep, this. I go, how about you get rid of all that shit and drop the 50 pounds? You know, I just remember kind of thinking shit like that. So I was never big in pharma. And that's part of my old another journey with my own health journey. But yeah, I would just see so much of that over and over again. And realizing what my mom was going through, I saw it in my own version. You know, it may not have been, you know, Colombians killing each other in the road, but we had Haitian kids killing each other in the road.
Yeah, but you know, but when you deal with death and you're dealing with dead bodies, it's like I used to say, even to the feds, doing some stuff down at Justice, but it's like, my homicide trumps your turf battles. I mean, a dead body, you know, a homicide really is at the top of the scale. I mean, it's like people don't realize is that it sounds like, oh, you must be used to this. No, I don't think you ever get used to it. I think you just, like you say, you kind of become not immune to it, but it's just kind of like trying to think of the right word to say without being disrespectful, but it's almost like it doesn't affect you anymore. It affects you, but it doesn't affect you. You show up, you compartmentalize, but you start realizing in your mind, how many collection of dead bodies and death scenes, you know, do you have there that are just stacking up, you know, one after the other? So it's not like, it's another old person. It's kind of like, well, here's a shoebox full of old people. Here's a shoebox full of kids. Here's a shoebox full of adults. And that kind of, that mental stuff just kind of catalogs in your mind and you never deal with it.
Yeah, there was, I remember my second day on FTO, 6 o'clock in the morning, there was shots fired, broken window. So we're like, somebody's pissed off. So we pull up, we're second unit. And there was a young girl, their boyfriend was, you know, it was like a murder-suicide situation, but he didn't kill himself yet. And he had shot her 6 times when she got into her car. And I still remember the smoke coming off of her body and her head. You know, it was like, oh, here we are. This is like real. And the bad guy ended up going down to Opa-locka, killing himself. And my mom was part of that investigation. It was kind of weird. For the first time in my career, overlap with my mom's because she left in 03. Here I am in 02. So it was that 1 year, you know, I wasn't talking to her one like, hey, mom, how you doing? You know, like on TV, you know, or, you know, at the scene. But I remember like, wow, how crazy that this bad guy ended up in my mom's jurisdiction down there and killed himself. And but you're right. You know, the next day, we had a homeless guy fall into the water. They couldn't find him. He drowned. And, you know, I'm on scene. They're pulling the bodies out. So it was right off the bat. Like my first week, I had two bodies. It was just like. Like you said, that's the real moment. That's when you're like, you know, and I didn't realize what that would do to me later, slowly, each body at a time. The body count goes up, and it's just not the body counts. It's the almost body counts, whether it's somebody that got maimed or somebody, you know, it's, and, you know, 20 years of that, I don't know how my mom did 30, you know, and it's insane. And I know maybe my being in a smaller department, we always were very seasoned, and the sheriff's office was, office would always pluck our best guys because we would get really taught the ropes. We'd learn fast how to write reports quick, you know, not get jammed up for the most part, even though that ended up happening. We had the Justice Department interview, you know, try to bust four of our cops later on for stuff. But, you know, that was a, you know, they ran, bad guys run over a cop, almost kill him. Cops catch the bad guy, beat the shit out of him, caught on video. And now they're going, and they're in federal court looking at civil rights violations for tuning up a scumbag that almost killed a cop. So that was like 2016. That was after my incident. So that's when I'm like, man, how long do I got? You know, I got 3 years. All right, I'm going to ride this out. Because I would have been one of those guys on scene, maybe losing my shit because it would have been a herd mentality. You know, and that was the end of the career. In the beginning, it was bad guys against us.
Well, and you want to burn a blue streak through the town. You were talking about it. You just triggered something in my mind. I was thinking about basically the first week I was on. I started off 1982 in Salina PD, Salina, Kansas. And the first week, two dead bodies. First one was an old guy that had a heart attack, fell over on top of a heater grate, you know, an older home. We get there. I thought, you know, first description was, I thought he was a, you know, black male or dark Hispanic male, white male. He'd just been there for so long, that heat. And the other one, unique to Kansas, but well, kind of when you have grain elevators, another guy fell into a grain elevator and suffocated to death, you know, inside grain. And so we've got, you know, we've got, you know, trying to get gosh, I just spaced out the name of it too, but you know, the stretcher up there, you know, the aerial stretcher, trying to get this guy, you know, out of there. And it's like, mm-hmm. Damn, yeah, for your first thought. But again, when you're young, you go, oh, this is cool. Then after a while you go, then you work homicides with young kids, babies that are shook, you know, shaken to death by their mother, traffic accidents with young kids. And you know, a tumor. If I mean, mm-hmm. So real quickly before we finish that was, those are the first two I remember. What do you remember, you know, in law enforcement? What was your first couple death scenes?
Who, me?
Yeah. Murph, I know it's early. Have you had your coffee?
The first one was an old person that passed away, a lady. And these are the ones you never forget. She had about 30 cats in the house.
Oh.
By the time we got the wellness check, she'd already been in there for about a week. You know, and the seasoned guys, the detectives don't tell you, you know, light a cigar, or put something under your nose. They just let you come in and experience that smell that will knock you back out the door. And it's something, you guys know, you never forget it. But you learn very quickly. This is what I like about having Eric on here, because you're talking about the career part, these things that when you're a younger man, you think, I'm a tough guy. I can handle anything. Yeah, that doesn't bother me. Yeah, I about threw up in the front yard, but I'm not going to let them know about it because you want to be part of the team. But that stuff does start weighing on you through your 20, 30-year career to the point where you can see when guys get to retirement age why there's maybe a few things that have come loose up in your head and you're wondering, how the hell did this happen? Where did this come from? You know, so this – Not giving anybody excuses for PTSD. If you suffer from it, you suffer from it. That's something that that you want to get help for. But it kind of explains how you become more perceptible to potentially having PTSD issues. When my partner got shot, Kevin, we've had him on the show, Eric. He got shot in 89 there in Hialeah. He survived, but the informant was shot in the throat and never made it to Jackson. It's just those things that build up with you. I was shell-shocked after that one, and I wasn't the one that got shot. But, you know, because I thought I was a tough guy, I didn't go to counseling. That was in 1989. I retired from DEA in 2013. I had dreams, not nightmares. I just relived that shooting multiple times. And as time went on, there was fewer and fewer. But since I retired from DEA, I haven't had that dream again.
And the first time him and his partner talked about it was 2 years ago. 1989, it took us till 2022 before him and his partner talked about it.
And we were, I mean, we were best friends. We still are. I mean, he's over in Sarasota. We still stay in touch, but we never talked about the shooting. He was off for about a year. I went to the Bahamas for a few months, you know, and when I came back, he came back. He was just back to work, you know, never even talked about it.
That's funny because there's an interesting relationship with Officer Monroe. He was the other officer with me on my shooting, and it's kind of similar. And how much do you want to talk about it? You know, it's, you know.
Yeah, you got to be careful. Is you don't want to talk about it so much where it sounds like you're relishing it, you know, reliving it, as opposed to are you dealing with it. But let's talk about that now. Let's get into this because you've got some time on the street. You're about, what, 11 years in? You know, you've been training the Utes. You know, you're a seasoned officer now. So let's talk about this day. And it's the day of the shooting. So, because, you know, there's video out there people can go see. But, I mean, you're dressed in a different kind of uniform, too. It looks like khakis, you know, and a like a polo, you know, but obviously police and you got your body armor and stuff. So what kind of work are you doing? Is that your standard uniform or what kind of things were you doing that day? What kind of unit were you in?
It was June in South Florida. So, you know, it's like 90 degrees. The humidity's killing us.
And so a black shirt. What, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, that's great. Well,
our chief was cool enough to let us use those tac vests. So at least if we got in an apartment or we were wanted to just loosen it up, and we were able to wear shorts, you know, and a lot of guys didn't like wearing shorts. Because I was a bicycle unit at one point, I got really comfortable with wearing the shorts. So I'm actually in shorts in that video. I'm the only guy in shorts, but I like to tell them I was a lot more tactically faster and all that, you know, because of the shorts, even though I got shot in the foot. Not that fast. So anyways, no, it was a regular day. I was leaving early because I was a senior guy on the day shift. And I always played basketball like Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. And we would meet up 6 o'clock, 10 of us, 11. So the numbers thing was important because if one guy doesn't show up and you got nine, you know, you got to run a half court now. And it just messes up the whole dynamic. So I remember, oh, I'm leaving at 6. This is nice. And it's, I think it was almost 4:30. And the bolo came out, you know, armed robbery, blackmail in Del Rey. It was a Chase Bank, and that's just south of us. And he left the scene in a red car, it said a red Crown Vic with a white top. I'm like, who robs a bank in like a pimpin' hootsie? Yeah, I mean, it was like red and white tops. So I was like, huh? Well, dispatch sent the night guys that were coming on the Bravo shift. So I'm looking at the board. I'm the only available unit in the whole city. And I know what that means, that DCF, that DUI crash, some crap I'm going to get stuck with, and what am I going to miss? Basketball. So I'm like, nah, dispatch, can you put me on that call boloing for the bank robber? Because there was no way chasing him. He could have gone south to Broward. He could have gone to 95. He could have parked at his house and just whatever. You know, there was nobody shot and killed. It was just another bank robber, you know. And I remember going to Woolbride and Federal Highway, which is US 1, and I saw... You know, you go to the intercoastal, you usually go over a bridge to get to the intercoastal part. And I saw a red car coming over the top of the bridge as I passed, you know, and had a white top. So I'm like, let me turn around. So I turn around, and as I pass by him again, he's now stopped at the red light, and I look over, and it's white top. And I remember the black male tapping the steering wheel. Ding, ding, ding. I'll never forget it. It was surreal. Like, he was... am I caught? Am I looking back? I can now reanalyze that moment as I pass him because I'm trying to see a face, you know, and I couldn't because he had dark tint. So it was almost like a ghost with his hands on the steering wheel, and you just see his finger like, he was just kind of.
One interesting thing we want to set the context for, too, because even though it's 2012, you guys are equipped with in-car cameras. So there's a little issue, too, with the in-car camera.
Right. So when I pass by him, and now I'm going to make a U-turn to see if he's going to go towards 95 or go to, and it's a Lincoln. It's not a Crown Vic, but they mess up that all, you know, that description all the time.
You confuse those too. Yeah.
So he makes a right and then I make a U-turn to get behind him, and he kind of guns it pretty fast at first. And I turn around. I'm like, yeah, he's taking off now. I've already told dispatch. I got a car matching description. So they're sending Austin Monroe a DUI unit that's at City Shop getting gas. Cause he's the closest guy. He decides to come my way. And I'm like, yeah, he's taking off kind of fast. I go, I haven't lit him up yet. You know, haven't turned on my lights. I'm just trying to gather information. And I kind of catch up to him a little bit. He slows down and he's got a handicap tag. And I'm like, man, is this some old timer coming from the beach or something? Just, you know, they drive erratically, you know, medications. I don't know what's going on with, you know, is he having a diabetic coma or something? So he ends up stopping. He just stops in the middle of US 1. I didn't hit my lights. He stops. I stop. behind him. And I'm sitting there. I go, yeah, dispatch. He just stopped right here in Federal Highway about 500 block or whatever. So now I hit my rear lights to let traffic know behind me. Hey, I got a car stopped here. We're just sitting there about 2-3 seconds. It seemed like an eternity. And in my head, I'm thinking, all right, what's going on? It didn't feel right. Right. And I'm listening to that little voice. You know, maybe the old me would have got out and approached the car sooner. Hey, your car matches the script, you know. So I waited. I didn't have to rush it at this point, you know, and that's a lot of the training and experience of certain things and older guys telling me, dude, hold up, you know. So I'm waiting on Monroe, the backup unit, to come. And then all of a sudden, bad guy takes off, floors it. And now I hit my lights, dispatch taken off. Now it's a chase. I'm like, oh, I think I got our bank robber, you know, or a guy with a suspended license that's not related to the bank robbery, because that happens all the time, right? I could be chasing a guy with weed in his pocket. So, you know, you're going into that thinking that too, because I don't have confirmation that this guy's armed or anything. So we get in a little chase. We go through some parking lots, 5 o'clock traffic is starting to thicken up. And that's when I was telling you about my camera, because they're always big on reviewing stuff. Make sure you follow procedure. And I'm thinking, if this guy isn't a bank robber, I got to make sure I'm not too reckless in chasing him. And I look up at my camera, and the old camera system, because the car was going to be replaced eventually, they're not going to spend more money putting a new system in an old car. So I looked up and it was off. I'm like, what? So I hit the power button and it's doing this 20-second, 30-second reboot. And meanwhile, I'm in a chase. You know, this guy's sideswiping cars. And then all of a sudden, we make a right turn on a railroad, which is an industrial area, you know, warehouses, mechanic shops, you know, trains just go by. And he made that right. I remember thinking, wow, he must know this area to make that right. And I look up again. Now my camera's ready, but it's not recording. I'm like, my lights and sirens, everything's going full, you know, tilt. And I hit the record button. And that's ended up what caught the shooting, because the other officer's car was crooked. And we start going. Chris is calling out the chase like you're supposed to, second car. And I'm thinking it's going to 95. There was even one boss got on the radio. He's like, what's it in reference to? You know, there's always that guy. You know, so it's like, armed robbery, Delray. You know, you hear somebody say some shit like that and it shut him up. You know, guy drinking his coffee, not paying attention. And so then he takes a quick left turn, like, you know, like a right angle, but he's making a quick left turn, but he cuts it too tight. And there's another car coming the other way. So they end up hitting head on, like, but he had slowed down enough to where the impact wasn't like an explosion. It was enough for the car just to bounce smoke from the, you know, grill and them hitting. So I'm up on him pretty fast because I'm not expecting the sudden stop. So my distance isn't like a felony stop. It's like, oh shit, now I'm here. Well, throw it in park, start to get out of the car. Monroe's coming to my right, you know, like we're going to park like a V or some sort. And all of a sudden I saw the door wiggling, you know, and I'm like, is he going to run? You know, remember, I thought he's a local guy to go down this railroad avenue already, you know, and they always run, you know, opens the door. And all I saw was, and I saw the ground bouncing. And I was like, oh, you know, and now I'm firing. I think they found one of my first rounds, which is nothing but suppression. I think I hit the house behind the car. There was nothing like, eh, let me line this up. You know, it was bam. Oh, you know, I'm being shot at. I may have been gangster style with it sideways. I don't even remember. And there was a telephone pole to my left. And I ran to the pole. And the way he was doing it, he couldn't get his door open. So he reaches out and he knows there's a cop here and there's a cop back here. And he just starts bam, 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 just shooting.
So, like, and the folks can't see you. So what you're saying is he's reaching out with his right hand. So if he's facing forward like it's 12 o'clock, he's like trying to shoot at his 4 o'clock and his 7 o'clock or something like that. Right.
And he's shooting between the door because the door can't get open because of the impact. It can get open a little bit. So he can't, and he doesn't know shoot through the window. So he's trying to shoot me around the door. It was not the best position for him at that point.
Hey players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.